We have made it almost all the way through the body, almost all the 11 organ systems. There's one left, and that last one, I shouldn't say last, I don't mean that it's not important, it is very important, like all organ systems, but the last one we're going to cover is the urinary system. We see an overview of the anatomy in slide one, and structurally, there's not much to it, at least at the macroscopic level. Physiologically, it's much more complex. Anatomically, the important structures are the two kidneys, of course. They are the most conspicuous organs and the most important organs. And then some plumbing, tubes that run from the kidneys to a storage device. The tubes that run from the kidneys are called ureters. There are two kidneys, so there's one ureter for each kidney, two overall ureters. The ureters conduct or carry the output of the kidneys, which is urine, to the storage device, which is the urinary bladder. Sometimes we call this just the bladder. Well, bladder just means bag. There are other kinds of bladders, like the gallbladder, for instance. So the proper name is the urinary bladder. The urinary bladder allows the urine that the kidneys produce to be stored until it's a more convenient time and place to get rid of it. So urine is more or less continuously being produced by the kidneys. That urine trickles through the ureters to the urinary bladder, which can expand quite a bit and hold quite a bit of urine. So the urine formation, which is done at the kidneys, happens continuously, and the urinary bladder gradually fills. What we call urination is also in anatomy and physiology called micturition, micturition. Micturition is the voiding or emptying of the bladder intermittently, whenever it's convenient. Otherwise, since urine is continuously being produced, it would be continuously trickling out of our body. The urinary bladder is there to hold it for later output. The kidneys are located in the abdominopelvic cavity, and you don't really see the detail here in this slide, but they are located retroperitoneally. That means they are behind the peritoneum, which we've talked about in other chapters. The peritoneum is a serous membrane in the abdominal cavity, but the kidneys are not inside that peritoneum. They are behind it or posterior to it, and retro means back. So retroperitoneal means located behind or posterior to the peritoneum. And therefore, the parietal peritoneum on the posterior side of the peritoneum would cover the anterior surface of the kidneys. They are embedded in the back wall if you were to dissect the body. And you might have noticed that when you looked at the rat dissection. The kidneys are more or less the same in size, but they're not the same in their placement. It's not a nice mirror image. There's a right kidney and a left kidney, but they are not at the same vertical position as you see here. Notice that the liver has been cut away. These are hepatic veins. Hepatic means of the liver. So they drain blood from the liver. The liver would be right here. It's a pretty large organ. And therefore, the right kidney is displaced a little bit inferiorly in the vertical direction because of that liver. The spleen isn't nearly as big as the liver, so the left kidney is a little bit higher. Now, if we go to slide two, we can see the placement from a rear view, and don't be confused by this. The ribs do partially protect the kidneys, even though you think of the ribs as thoracic. It's true that they are thoracic, but the thoracic cavity is officially divided from the abdominal pelvic cavity by the diaphragm, and the diaphragm is superior to the kidneys, as you see. If I go quickly back to the first slide, this is the diaphragm right here. So the kidneys are truly fully in the abdominal pelvic cavity, but they are still protected by the lower ribs. Now on to three. Let's just focus on one kidney here, which has been sectioned with a coronal section, and each individual kidney is often described as bean-shaped. In fact, that's exactly obviously why we call kidney beans. They look like little kidneys. So it has this shape with a depression where this major plumbing is attached to the kidney. That region, it's not labeled here, that region is called the hilum, H-I-L-U-M. And when we look at the interior, we can see that this is another example of a structure that has fundamentally different cortex versus medulla. Remember, those words are used for various organs that have different layers when you cut into their thickness. And cortex always means more superficial, medulla is deeper. So the renal cortex, renal just means of the kidney, is what you find just deep to the fibrous capsule that actually encloses the entire kidney. That's the lighter colored reddish pink here. And then the darker areas, each one is roughly circular. It's actually more triangular than circular. Those are called renal pyramids. They're called pyramids because of their triangular shape. So there are several different renal pyramids in each kidney, and the renal pyramids and everything else in that layer makes up the renal medulla. Now, calyx is a word that means goblet originally. So these calyces, that's the plural of calyx, were named this in a kidney because they kind of resemble a goblet. A goblet is a drinking glass that narrows to a stem, right? So they're kind of funnel-shaped. These are funnel-shaped structures, the calyces. And there are minor calyces and major calyces. There's a minor calyx corresponding to each individual renal pyramid. And so each minor calyx collects the urine from one renal pyramid. So however many pyramids there are, there's that many minor calyces. And then two or more minor calyces converge into a bigger calyx here and there. Those are called major calyces. And then the major calyces combine into an even bigger funnel-shaped thing that is, you could think maybe that they would also call that a calyx, but this is not labeled here. This is called the renal pelvis. Now, pelvis is a word that means bowl. In fact, when you think about the pelvic girdle on the skeleton, if you look at just the pelvic girdle, it's roughly bowl-shaped, very wide and shallow. So that's why this was called the renal pelvis. It's much wider than the goblet-like calyces. But the minor calyces collect urine from the pyramids and deliver it to the major calyces. The major calyces deliver that urine to the renal pelvis. And then the renal pelvis narrows as it exits the kidney through the hilum. And that's the beginning of that kidney's ureter. And then that will transport that urine all the way down to the urinary bladder. Also connected at the hilum are major other tubes for blood. This ureter is a tube for urine, but there are also blood vessels that run into and out of the kidney through the hilum, and those include renal artery and renal vein, bringing blood to the kidney in the case of the renal artery and taking blood away from the kidney in the case of the renal vein. We get a better look at this in cartoon view in slide 4. Here we can see how the vasculature works. So this is the renal artery I was just talking about. This indentation area where everything is connected to it, that's the hilum I was talking about. And as you would expect for an artery, it branches. Arteries branch into smaller blood vessels. So the renal artery, which branches itself right off of the abdominal aorta, so it's a major blood artery. It carries a lot of blood to each kidney. The kidneys process a lot of blood. Anyway, each kidney features its own renal artery, and then the renal artery splits into smaller arteries called segmental arteries. And that's because there are several segments within the kidney. Segmental arteries then subdivide into what are called interlobar arteries. Inter means between, lobar means of lobes. Well, the lobes here are the pyramids. Notice that the interlobar arteries are making their way through the medulla toward the cortex, but are situated between the pyramids or lobes, and therefore they're called interlobar arteries. Those interlobar arteries then branch into what are called arcuate arteries, because they arc over the superficial part of each pyramid. And then the arcuate arteries further branch into even smaller ones called radiate arteries. And radiate means that they form little radii. If you think of this thing as an actual circle, a radius of a circle goes from center toward the circle itself. So these are all situated radially. Now, cortical just is the adjective of cortex. So the radial the radiate arteries are all situated in the renal cortex. So that's why they're called cortical radiate arteries. Subdivisions go even finer than that. We don't see that detail on this slide, but we'll look at it in a minute. Anyway, when it comes time for the blood to return, it's largely the reverse of what we just said for the arteries. There are cortical radiate veins, and then they empty into arcuate veins, which then empty into bigger ones. They're called interlobar veins. And then finally into the renal vein itself, one from each vein that empties into the inferior vena cava for a trip back to the heart. You get a view of the fibrous capsule that I was talking about in the previous slide. It wasn't labeled in that one, but it is here. The fibrous capsule is fibrous connective tissue that protects the kidney exteriorly. Okay, now let's look at a little finer detail. Look at where we are here with the inset. So this is just a little piece of the interior of the kidney, but part of this piece is in the cortex, as you see, and part of it is in the medulla. This biggest of these arteries shown here, which is not a big artery, but it's the biggest of this little figure, this is the arcuate artery we were talking about. So this section down here in the renal medulla would be part of one pyramid. Can see that right here. So this arcuate artery, as I said in the previous slide, branches into smaller ones called radiate arteries. These are radiate arteries right here. And then radiate arteries split again into even smaller arteries called afferent arteries that go directly into the functional unit of a kidney. Now the functional unit of the kidney is called the nephron. It's another word besides renal that comes from a root meaning kidney. So nephric is a word that means of the kidney or of the nephron. And renal also means pretty much the same thing, of the kidneys. But each kidney contains between a million and a million and a half nephrons. That's each kidney. And since a normal human has two kidneys, that means a normal healthy human has between 2 and 3 million of these nephrons. The nephron is the functional unit of the kidney, which means in order for the kidney to do its job, you need everything that a nephron has. And then There's just hundreds of thousands of those, like I said, more than a million of them in each kidney, doing the same thing. But even though they are really doing the same thing, there are two categories of nephrons, and those are cortical nephrons, which are situated entirely in the cortex, that's what cortical means, and juxtamedullary nephrons. Now, juxta means next to, and medullary means of the medulla. So juxtamedullary nephrons are not entirely in the medulla. They are partially in the cortex, but a part of the nephron extends into the medulla. That's why they're called juxtamedullary nephrons. And the juxtamedullary nephrons are really important because they are what are what allows the kidneys to produce highly concentrated urine. More about that in a little bit, but let's talk a little bit more about the structure of a nephron. As I said, that a complete nephron is the functional unit of the kidney, but there are different parts making up a single nephron, whether it's cortical or juxtamedullary. Every nephron has two parts that make it up, one of which is called a renal corpuscle, and the other of which is called a renal tubule. And we'll get a better view of this when we look even closer up in the next slide. But we can see that each nephron is associated with a capillary bed, which is where these finer and finer arteries that keep branching eventually lead to. And this makes sense because the major job of the kidneys is to process the blood. Now, this collecting duct that you see happening between these two pictured nephrons, there's, like I said, hundreds of thousands of these. There are many, many collecting ducts as well, but each collecting duct is collecting the output from several different nephrons. And then several different collecting ducts will empty into eventually a minor calyx, and then those will empty into the major calyx and so on until it's finally out through the renal pelvis and into the ureter. It being urine, by the way. Now, while we're still here with labels, let me repeat the two parts of every nephron. It's renal corpuscle and renal tubule. But you can subdivide it again. The renal corpuscle is made of two parts, one of which is the glomerulus. Plural of that is glomeruli. Each nephron has its own glomerulus, which is a ball-like capillary bed. So it is, it's directly comes from the blood artery called the afferent arteriole that comes into the renal corpuscle. So that's part, the glomerulus is part of the renal corpuscle. The glomerulus is covered, though, by a sac-like structure directly surrounding it, and that is called either the Bowman's capsule or the renal capsule, nephric capsule or Bowman's capsule. Bowman is a dead human, but nephric capsule is more descriptive. Anyway, what I'm calling the renal corpuscle is the combination of the glomerulus and the capsule that surrounds it. Okay, so that's part of the overall nephron. The tubule, the kidney tubule, is the rest of the nephron. So the capsule is kind of like a funnel structure that collects the stuff that comes out of the glomerulus, and then that leads to the kidney tubule itself, or the nephric tubule, which is the rest of the overall nephron. And so both of those parts are in both of the kinds of nephrons, whether cortical or juxtamedullary. The tubule itself, just like the corpuscle had parts to it, the tubule has parts to it. And so those important parts are the proximal convoluted tubule, the nephron loop, which can also be called the loop of Henle, H-E-N-L-E, and the distal convoluted tubule. Well, convoluted means twisted. Proximal and distal, you already know the meanings of, right? Proximal means closer to the point of attachment when we're talking about parts of the body, like the appendages. But proximal and distal can also apply to something that has directional flow. And things are the stuff we're going to be talking about that eventually is called urine is flowing through this in a specific direction. That's why this is called the proximal convoluted tubule, because it's first in line, and then the nephric loop, or loop of Henle, and then the distal convoluted tubule, which is also convoluted. And then that eventually, the distal convoluted tubule, eventually empties in to a collecting duct that's nearby. Now let's go to 6 and take an even closer look. So here we have an arcuate artery. We saw that in the previous slide as well. And the branch from the arcuate artery is a cortical radiate artery. And then it branches even into smaller arteries, which are really arterioles, called afferent arterioles. We're looking at just one afferent arteriole here. Remember that afferent means incoming, just like we applied that word to the nervous system. And efferent means outgoing. So that's why this was called the afferent arteriole. It's bringing blood into the nephron. And so the afferent arteriole branches even into smaller blood vessels that are capillaries, right? Capillaries are smaller than arterioles. Well, this ball of capillaries is the glomerulus. Okay, so it's glomerular capillaries is really just another phrase that you could say the same thing in by saying glomerulus. The space that immediately surrounds the glomerulus but is inside the Bowman's capsule or glomerular capsule or nephric capsule, they all really mean the same thing. That space is called the capsular space. Space within the capsule. And so that's the very beginning of the nephron. Once again, the corpuscle, the renal corpuscle, is the combination of Bowman's capsule and the glomerulus. And then that leads to the rest of the nephron, which is the renal tubule, which consists of the proximal convoluted tubule, the nephric loop, or nephron loop, or loop of Henle, and then the distal convoluted tubule. And by the time you're at the end of the distal convoluted tubule where it empties into the collecting duct, that is the end of the nephron. Now, the nephron, notice, is also surrounded by blood vessels all around the renal tubule. And that's because there's going to be exchange between the renal tubule and the blood. So that makes sense. Now, an even closer view in slide 7 shows just one capsule. And you can see that the glomerulus, which is the bundle of blood capillaries within this corpuscle, those capillaries are surrounded by cells shown in yellow here called podocytes. Now, pod or pod means foot, so this means foot cells. They're called that because each podocyte has several different extensions or cell processes sticking out from it that are kind of like feet. That's why they get their name. And this is important because these slits between these feet make a filter. And that's really important for the first part of what the kidneys really do. There's three major functions of the kidney, the first of which is filtration. So blood is coming into the nephron via the afferent arteriole. The afferent arteriole is a small artery that branched from one of the radiate arteries in the cortex. That then gives rise to the actual capillary bed that we call the glomerulus, surrounded by the podocytes, and then that blood leaves the corpuscle through the efferent arteriole. Now, the amount of material that comes out through the efferent arteriole is smaller than the amount that comes in, because being a filter, some of the material in the blood is going to leave the bloodstream and get filtered through these slits into the capsular space. And therefore, there's not going to be as much left in the bloodstream, in the arteries coming out. That's why the efferent arteriole is smaller, as you see here. PCT, by the way, is just short for proximal convoluted tubule. Now to slide 8. This is an actual photograph rather than a cartoon, but you can see these foot processes, many foot processes branching from these podocytes covering the glomeruli, or one glomerulus per capsule. And so it's kind of like taking two combs and sticking the teeth together. That makes many fine slits, which makes it a nice filter. And really anything that is small enough to leave the bloodstream, leave the walls of the glomerulus and get squeezed through these tiny slits, will be filtered. Just like anything that you pass through a filter that is small enough is going to go through it, whether you want it to or not. It's and I say that because the filtration, which is the first part of what the kidney does, is based only on size. It's not on whether or not you actually want that stuff to leave the blood. It's going to leave if it's small enough, and it's going to go through these slits, these filtration slits. Well, let's look at this in schematic view in slide 9. So we have the radiate artery branching into afferent arteriole. That's bringing blood into the renal corpuscle directly through the glomerulus inside that corpuscle. Now, the blood in this glomerulus is, of course, pressurized. That's the blood pressure. So it's blood pressure that drives the first of three major renal processes. You see the processes listed here. And those processes are filtration, reabsorption, and secretion. But notice where these things occur. Filtration occurs only at the glomerulus. So that's why it's called glomerular filtration. And filtration always happens first, so that's why it's number one here. So the blood pressure squeezes anything that's small enough out of the capillaries, because these capillaries are not only capillaries, they're especially leaky capillaries compared to capillaries in the rest of the body. So anything small enough will squeeze out of the capillaries, and if they're small enough to get through those filtration slits made by the podocytes, that stuff will exit the bloodstream. And that's what this purple arrow refers to. Notice that's filtration removes things from the blood. And that's going to cause an accumulation of fluid in this capsular space. Now that fluid is not yet properly called urine. It's called filtrate. If you think back to the digestive system chapter, remember that we only called food food while it was in the mouth. And then, even though it's the same stuff after saliva and stuff has been mixed with it, when it gets to the stomach, we no longer call it food. We called it chyme, and then later on we call it feces. Well, similarly here, we're calling this stuff different things. At first, it's called filtrate. And that's simply because it results from blood being filtered. Now, eventually, we're going to call this urine, but it's not in its final form yet. So it's called filtrate at this point. And that's the only one of the three processes that the kidney performs that occurs in the capsule or in the corpuscle, glomerular filtration. Now, the tubule, which is the rest of the nephron, performs both of the other two jobs, which are reabsorption and secretion. And reabsorption and secretion both happen at multiple places along the tubule, It depends on what actually the thing is that's being reabsorbed or secreted. But they happen both along the tubule itself. The fundamental difference between reabsorption and secretion is that reabsorption brings things back into the bloodstream. Remember, things left the bloodstream by glomerular filtration. So they are now, whatever those things are that left the blood, are now part of the filtrate. Well, as I said before, anything that's small enough gets filtered. Some of those things you don't want in your body, and that's why you're filtering the blood. So you want to keep those things out of the bloodstream. But there's plenty of small things that get filtered as well, like water molecules and glucose, to name two important ones. Some of those things you didn't actually want to leave the blood, you just couldn't help it because they're small enough, so you need to bring them back into the blood. That's what reabsorption is all about. And so water, glucose, amino acids, these are things that are necessary. Proteins are made of amino acids, but remember, proteins are huge molecules because they're hundreds or thousands of amino acids big, so they don't get filtered from the blood to begin with. And that's why protein in the blood is a sign of something that's gone wrong. But amino acids individually are small enough to sometimes be filtered, and they need to be brought back in. So the good stuff that got filtered needs to be reabsorbed. Reabsorption means reabsorbed back into the bloodstream. That means it's leaving the nephron and going back into the bloodstream. Secretion, in terms of direction, is exactly the opposite of reabsorption. That moves things from the bloodstream into the filtrate. Now, so does filtration, remember. But there's a fundamental difference. Filtration is driven just by the hydrostatic pressure, or the liquid pressure, which is the blood pressure, squeezing things out. Not all things that you want to get rid of from the bloodstream are going to be able to leave during filtration. There are some bigger things that will not be filtered, but you still want to get rid of them. That's why later on, things that are still in the blood, but you want to get rid of them, will have to be secreted. And secretion removes things from the blood and puts them into the kidney tubule so that it will become part of the urine. Now, when all three of these processes are done, which is not until you get to the collecting duct, in fact, not even at the beginning of the collecting duct, some distance down the collecting duct, only then is the composition of this fluid not going to change anymore. And when it's in its final form, then we properly call it urine. And once it's urine, it's not going to change. It's just going to be transported through ureters into the urinary bladder. So urinary bladder contains urine that has a certain amount of water in it plus other things. You can't reclaim that water. The urine does not change post-renally or after the kidneys have processed it. This is why, for instance, you can't chug a gallon of water and expect to be able to go out and work in direct sunlight in July for hours, and even though you have a full bladder, you'll think, well, I'll just allow that water to go back into my bloodstream from the bladder. It doesn't work that way for us. After the kidneys are done, there's nothing can be done about it. Now, there are some animals that actually can do that, but we're not among those. So the urine is in final form once we call it urine, and all we can do is store it and then release it, eventually in micturition. Okay, now, if we look at 10, we can see one nephron drawn being connected to the collecting duct. Several different nephrons collect to a single collecting duct, like I said, but here we're looking at just one nephron. And this is not a cortical nephron, because a cortical nephron would have its loop entirely within the cortex. It would have a much shorter loop. This is a juxtamedullary nephron, which I said earlier when I introduced the term, are important for concentrating the urine. Now, concentrating means making urine that is not very watery. There's a low amount of water, and there's a high concentration of solutes, salts, and other things. So this is important for the overall job of the kidneys in maintaining proper fluid balance in the body. Sometimes it's appropriate to make dilute urine, which is very watery, and that's because sometimes you have too much, you know, fluid in the blood. If you absorb a lot of water by drinking a lot of water, that is going to get put into the bloodstream, just like the foods we eat. Those nutrients eventually get put into the bloodstream. That's going to increase the blood volume, which is going to increase the blood pressure. And so in those cases, it's appropriate for the kidneys to respond by allowing that water that's filtered to stay in the filtrate and become part of the urine rather than putting it back into the blood. That would be appropriate, in other words, to make dilute urine during that time. And other times when you have not drunk sufficiently and your blood volume has gone down, you don't want to waste any water from that blood. Now, some of that water is going to come out anyway in the filtration. It's important to reclaim it before you finalize the urine. And so that's able to be done because of a concentration gradient that is established and maintained in the kidneys. And notice the coloring on the background here. It goes from yellow to brown gradually. That represents a concentration gradient of salts, sodium and chloride, principally, and also urea. Anyway, what the yellow region means, which is cortical, is low concentration of solutes, and then it gets higher and higher as you go from cortex to deeper and deeper in the medulla. So this is very salty extracellular fluid down here. And the reason that that is able to exist is because of movement of fluid through these long loops of Henle, or nephric loops, or nephron loops. Now, each loop, each single loop, there's one loop in the overall nephron, but each loop contains two limbs, a descending limb, named for the fact that the fluid moving through it is going down in the figure toward the medulla, and then an ascending limb. So the descending limb and the ascending limb are both part of the loop, but they do different things. They allow things through their walls differently. And as you see here, the descending limb allows water through it, and so water is continuously leaving the filtrate as the filtrate is moving down the descending limb. And since water is leaving it and leaving solutes behind in the filtrate, that is concentrating the filtrate. On the way back up, in the ascending limb, water does not go through these walls of the ascending limb. Instead, salt does. And so some salt leaves because of a gradient, and some salt leaves actively. The red arrow is active transport, the blue is passive transport, but it's sodium and chloride ions both leaving the filtrate on the way up. Okay, now so this is really the mechanism that maintains this overall gradient within the kidney and makes the deeper and deeper parts of the medulla more and more salty. That's important because the final adjustment of the wateriness of the urine is going to occur at the collecting ducts, and the collecting ducts go through this medulla. So if you go farther and farther down a collecting duct, the surroundings become more and more salty. And therefore, if you open up water channels, which are called aquaporins, then water will leave the collecting ducts. If you keep those aquaporins closed, then the water will stay in the urine. And so this is the actual function of antidiuretic hormone. Diuresis, D-I-U-R-E-S-I-S, refers to the production of a large volume of dilute or watery urine. And therefore, antidiuresis is the production, is the opposite. It's the production of a small volume of not watery but highly concentrated urine. An antidiuretic hormone reaches the kidney and tells the collecting duct to open up those water channels. And therefore, the water that's in this final form of the filtrate leaves the filtrate and goes back into the kidney, staying in the body, and that concentrates the urine. And as it goes farther and farther down, it encounters an even steeper gradient, and therefore even more water can be removed. This is why we can form such highly concentrated urine. And the longer the loops of Henle are, the more concentrated it can be. Let's pay attention to the other arrows that are happening here, though. Remember, there's three overall renal processes. Filtration is what has already occurred in the renal corpuscle. That removed things from the blood that are small enough from the glomerulus and put it into the filtrate. So the filtrate gets created by filtration. Now what we have for the rest of it in the tubule is a combination of reabsorption and secretion. And so different things get reabsorbed and secreted at different places, as you can see here. But always make sense of these arrows. Notice that these ones are leaving the tubule, but that means those things that are leaving the tubule, they're leaving the filtrate, are being put back into the body, being put back into the blood. So all of these arrows leaving the tubule represent reabsorption. All of the arrows entering the tubule are things that didn't get filtered but need to be gotten rid of in the urine. So like drugs and poisons, for instance, here, those need to be pumped into the tubule using energy to pump them in there to get rid of them. Okay, now to slide 11. We're looking at the opening of the interior of the urinary bladder here. On either side, you see a ureter, one from each kidney. And so when you look at it from the interior view, you can see that the ureters do indeed empty into the urinary bladder because each one has a little orifice, a ureteral orifice. The ureters connect to the urinary bladder at the posterior surface of the urinary bladder, but that represents two openings, which are two corners of a triangle. A triangle, of course, has three corners, and that's why this region in the urinary bladder is called the trigone, which really just means triangle. The third corner is another opening, which is an exit in this case. The ureteral orifices are entries into the urinary bladder, but they form two of the three corners of a triangle. The third corner is an opening that's an exit from the urinary bladder, and that's called the internal urethral orifice. Now, don't confuse ureteral and urethral. The ureters bring urine into the urinary bladder from the kidneys. The urethra empties the urinary bladder to allow for micturition. And so in a female, this is a more simple structural organization because a female has a dedicated tube just for urine. That's what her urethra is. As we talked about in the reproductive system chapter, in a male, the urethra does double duty. So it also empties the urinary bladder of urine, but remember there's also another connection from the prostate in males. And semen gets delivered into the urethra as well. The urethra does double duty in a male as functions for conducting urine during micturition and also for conducting semen during ejaculation. This urogenital diaphragm, that is just another name for the floor of the pelvic cavity. And so remember when I talked in males about the fact that the urethra has different parts to it, the membranous urethra was called that because this is the membrane, urogenital diaphragm, that part of the urethra goes through. But in a female, it's just urethra because she doesn't have a penis. In slide 12, we can see a cartoon of the urinary bladder to give you an appreciation of how big it can get. The urinary bladder, when it's empty, if you dissected a human, the bladder would be empty, of course, and it would be pretty small and very, it'd be like a just a flap, basically, an empty bag. But it can become very highly distended. Now, there's a limit, of course, but we usually don't allow that limit to get reached because we're in pain before that happens, and we have to micturate in order to relieve the buildup of pain. But it's impressive just how far distended or stretched the urinary bladder can get. And this is why there is a special epithelium. We talked a little bit about this in the early part of the course. A special type of epithelium lining the interior surface of the urinary bladder. An ordinary epithelium, if you were to stretch it, it would separate the cells that make up that epithelium. And so it would put holes in it, basically. But the urinary bladder is made up of a special epithelium called transitional epithelium that has many layers, and when it's unstretched, those cells are columnar. When it gets stretched, those cells go from being more columnar, which are tall, to being more squamous, which are wide and short, to fill up the space that would normally occur in the holes that would normally occur if, by damaging a conventional epithelium. Slide 13. Now we're looking at total body water, as you see, and that's all the water in the body, of course, total body water. But there are two major compartments that body water is in. Now, this is just an average, 40 liters of water in an average adult. Of course, some people are bigger, some are smaller, but 40 liters on average. The two major compartments, though, are intracellular fluid, ICF, which is, of course, the fluid inside the cells. Now, you have 100 trillion cells in your body. Each one contains a tiny amount of fluid called its own intracellular fluid, but when you combine all of the intracellular fluid from all the cells of the body, that makes up about 40% of your total body weight, as you see here, 25 liters of the 40 liters total. The other compartment is extracellular fluid. So any fluid that's not inside a cell is part of the extracellular fluid. But there are two parts to the extracellular fluid, as you see here. Interstitial fluid is extracellular fluid, but it is specifically fluid that is between cells in the tissues of the various tissues of the body, other than blood. So throughout the body, you have interstitial fluid, just fluid that's outside of the cells and just between the cells. Then you have the blood, which, remember, is a connective tissue, and like all connective tissues, there's a cellular component, that's the blood cells. Well, the blood cells have fluid in them, but that's part of intracellular fluid. And then you have the other part of the connective tissue called blood, which is plasma. The extracellular matrix of blood is called plasma. And that is extracellular because it's outside of those cells. But it's also locked in its own compartment called the bloodstream. It's inside the blood vessels. So that's why it's really considered separately from interstitial fluid. So plasma and interstitial fluid combined make up extracellular fluid. And these three major compartments then, you can see shown in slide 14. So the blood plasma is, of course, in the compartment we call the bloodstream, inside the blood vessels, arteries and veins. Interstitial fluid is outside of the bloodstream and also outside of the cells. And then you have fluid that's inside the cells, which is intracellular fluid. And notice how these compartments interact with various organ systems in the body. The lungs, which are, of course, part of the respiratory system, they directly exchange oxygen and carbon dioxide with the blood. But then the blood exchanges oxygen and carbon dioxide with interstitial fluid surrounding cells of the body. And then the interstitial fluid exchanges oxygen and carbon dioxide with the intracellular fluid in the actual cells of the body. They take in that oxygen. That oxygen is now dissolved in the intracellular fluid, and the cells get rid of the CO2. It becomes part of the interstitial fluid, and then it makes its way into the bloodstream as it goes through the capillaries surrounding these cells. Now it's in the blood plasma, and then eventually goes back to the blood, to the lungs, and leaves the blood plasma, goes into the airspace in the lungs, and gets exhaled. The digestive system also exchanges things with the blood, but it's nutrients and water and ions mostly, as you see here. But then, the blood plasma exchanges those things with the interstitial fluid, which then exchanges those things with the fluid inside the cells, or the intracellular fluid. Well, the third system shown here is the one we are focusing on in this chapter, which is the urinary system. So, what urine is really just filtered blood. I shouldn't say just filtered. It's, like I said, it's filtered, reabsorbed, and secreted. All three of these are involved in urine formation. But if you've never wondered about where urine comes from, it really is just part of blood. Things that get filtered and then not put back into the blood, along with things that have been secreted into the filtrate, that is what urine is. But it all comes from blood originally. Another way of saying that is that blood is urine with other things in it as well. Urine is just part of what was in blood. And the things that get removed from the body as urine are things that should be gotten rid of. You know, that's why we have reabsorption, to put the things that got filtered back into the blood that are important. But the things that we want to keep out of the body are wastes of various kinds. Importantly, that includes nitrogenous waste. Now, nitrogenous just means nitrogen-containing. And if we think about nutrition, there's three major nutrient classes in our foods. Those are carbohydrates, lipids, and proteins. We bring all of these into the body from the food, but like I discussed in the digestive system chapter, what we usually use for energy after digestion has occurred and absorption into the body has occurred by the digestive system, what we usually use in the cells of the body for energy are carbohydrates and fatty acids that come from lipids. We usually do not use proteins, even though we can. Proteins, rather, are recycled. They're broken down into amino acids, and then those amino acids are rearranged to make our own proteins for whatever jobs they need to perform inside the cells. Sometimes, though, we can use proteins as energy, as fuel, and when that happens, we need to get rid of something that the amino acids have that are from proteins that the other fuels don't. Carbohydrates and lipids do not have nitrogen in them, but proteins made of amino acids have nitrogen in them. And when we use those as fuels, we need to get rid of that nitrogen. The body does that by removing nitrogen in the form of ammonia, which is toxic if it builds up. So an important thing that the liver does is to not let the ammonia level get too high. Instead, as ammonia gets produced by using proteins as fuel, the liver will produce something that is also toxic, but not quite as toxic, called urea. And then that urea travels from the liver, where it's made, to the kidneys, and then the kidneys get rid of the urea as part of urine. And this is why the urine will look quite different in someone who's eaten a lot of protein versus someone who's had nothing but sugars, for instance. But anyway, the nitrogenous waste comes from breaking down proteins. It's not the only thing that needs to be gotten rid of in urine, but it's a big part of it. So these three fluid compartments, are always communicating with each other and exchanging materials. 15. Now we have average intake and average output of fluids and what the breakdown is for each of these. So this is really, I say fluids, it's really specifically water that we're talking about here, body water. Metabolism accounts for 10% of the intake. Now, intake does not mean just drinking. Metabolism is 10%. We make water by using fuels like I was just talking about. Carbohydrates, for instance. Glucose is a carbohydrate. It's the major fuel in all cells. When you use glucose as fuel, when you combust it, which is really what glycolysis and cellular respiration happening inside of cells does, it dismantles that glucose molecule until all that's left over is carbon dioxide. That's why carbon dioxide is created in your body. It's what's left over from the foods that you ate that are used as fuel. But anyway, in that process, water gets produced as a byproduct. Now, this is not water that you're drinking. This is water that we make in our bodies from the fuels that we catabolize. And that it really amounts to quite a bit, 10% of the daily intake of water that's added to the body. But it came in as nutrients. We also get water just from the fact that the food that we eat is wet. This is different from the water that we produce out of glucose and other fuels. This is just water in watery foods. So even stuff that we consider to be dry foods has quite a bit of water in it, actually. That's a 30%. And then, of course, we also drink water. Or things, beverages that have a lot of, that are mostly water. So all of those are adding water to the body each day. Well, there are also things that remove water from the body each day. So we lose 4% or so in the feces. Now the large intestine, if it weren't for the large intestine, that would be a much bigger number that we would lose, because that's a major function of large intestines. The absorption has already occurred, absorption of nutrients has already occurred in the small intestine. The large intestine then dries out the residue, which eventually become the feces. So they take the water out of that and put it back into the body so that it doesn't get wasted. Still, though, the feces have to be wet enough in order to be eliminated, and so that removes some of the water. We are also sweating sometimes, and especially here, and especially this time of year. That's sweating is coming from sweat glands, of course, but what we call sweat is mostly water. And then there are insensible losses via the skin and lungs. So not all the water that we lose through our skin is from sweat. The sweat comes from glands. But the skin itself is actually continuously losing water at a certain rate directly through the skin itself. Not through sweating, but just evaporation directly through the skin. And also we lose a lot of water, as I talked about in the respiratory system chapter, each breath. Some of that gets reclaimed, but each breath obviously contains water vapor. This is why you might see in an old movie a typical way of seeing whether a body is actually dead is put up a little pocket mirror to the nose. That's to see whether there is condensation of water vapor from any breath that might be coming through that person's nose or mouth. So every breath we lose some water. That's insensible. It just means that we're not realizing we're doing it. We can feel ourselves sweat. We don't feel ourselves evaporate water directly through the skin or through the lungs. And then, of course, there's also urine. And this urine one, this compartment and beverages on the left, those are the most highly variable of all of these. The rest of these things are pretty constant. But obviously we can drink more or drink less in a given day, and we can produce more or less urine. Well, the reason we produce more or less urine depends primarily on how much we drink. If we intentionally drink more than we need, we're going to produce a more dilute urine, because antidiuretic hormone will not be produced in that case. On the other hand, if we go without drinking, which you shouldn't do very long, but if you do it for a while and get thirsty, you're not only going to get thirsty to remind you to drink, but a signal will also be sent to the brain to tell it to release antidiuretic hormone, which will cause that water that would have been put into the urine to be put back into the body at the collecting duct. And so, in other words, urine production matches the needs of the body. And in a homeostatic body, the total amount of water taken in should match the total amount taken out so that homeostasis is achieved and maintained. That is the chapter.